desperately need that spirit in the pulpit today and in the pews. If we don't get it, we're going to lose it. Now, I'm convinced of that as much as I'm convinced of anything. Well, let me give you just a little bit about myself. I'm speaking again on Saturday here at the conference, so I don't want to get over into what I'm going to be talking about then, because they are going to be talking about the role that preachers and church leaders and Christians can play in this effort. So I don't want to overlap too much. But I was called to preach at a pretty early age and started preaching at the age of 16. I turned 40 just a few weeks, I mean 60, just a few weeks ago. I was thinking of my wife's age, Jesus 40. Turned 60 just a few weeks ago. I've been a full-time pastor since I was 24. So basically all I've ever done, I taught school for about 3 years, public school, but basically all I've ever done is pastor. So I've spent my life in the ministry. And then, while I was pastoring a church out west of Oklahoma City, a place called Yukon, a church of about 1,000, I ran for and was elected to our Oklahoma legislature, where I served for a few terms, and it was only a few, and I'll tell you why. It wasn't because I got defeated, it's because I walked away, and there's some reasons why I did that. But I served there while still pastoring that very large church. And then, almost 2 years ago now, I ran for governor in Oklahoma. Many of you were incredibly supportive of us. And I just want to take this opportunity to thank all of you, because I know there are probably a good number of you in this room who either supported us by praying for us, by encouraging us. Many of you traveled to Oklahoma at some of our rallies. And then some of you faithfully supported financially our campaign. And I know that was a sacrifice, and I want to thank you for that. So, it was a privilege to do what I did. Now, a lot of people say, well, why in the world, Dad, did you want to become a politician? I said, politician? Have you noticed where they rank these days? It's down there around used car salesmen and ptomaine poisoning. I mean, I don't want to be a politician. It's kind of like the story I heard of three guys that were out driving. They got lost way out in the country. It was cold, ran out of fuel, didn't know what to do. So they decided, well, we're just going to try to find some place to stay. It's too cold to stay in the car. They start walking. Finally, they see a light. Turns out to be a farmhouse. They walk up to the door. Knock like this. The farmer comes to the door rubbing his eyes. It's late. And he says, look, I can give two of you a room here in the house, but one of you must stay in the barn. Well, it just so happened that these three men were from very mixed backgrounds. One was Hindu, one was Jewish, and one was a politician. And so, the Hindu said, well, look, I'll stay in the barn, you two sleep in the house. So they all get in and get settled. In about 10 minutes, knock on the door. They thought, who in the world could this be? The farmer goes back to the door. There stands the Hindu man. He says, look, I can't sleep in the barn. There are cattle in there. That could be Aunt Gertrude, Uncle Joe. I can't sleep in there tonight. Okay, so the Jewish man says, I'll sleep in the barn. So he goes out there, they all get settled in, and finally, about 10 minutes, he comes to the door, says, look, I can't sleep out there. There are pigs. I can't sleep with hogs. So what are we going to do? And finally, the politician said, look, I'm a servant of the people. I should have gone first. I'll go in there, and I'll sleep in the barn. So everybody gets settled in. About 10 minutes passes. Another knock at the door. The farmer thinks, now, what in the world could be his problem? He opens the door, and there stands a cow and a pig. So there are some people that even cattle and hogs won't sleep with. So I just want you to know right now, I didn't want to be a politician. That was not the plan at all. So I get elected to the legislature, and I'm a believer. I'm not just a believer. I'm a lowercase. I'm a pastor. So anyway, I'm a pastor who happens to be a believer. And I'm in the legislature in Oklahoma. Now, many of you think that Oklahoma is one of the most conservative of all conservative states. Now, the reason why you think that is because you watch how we vote in presidential elections. And I will admit to you that every county in Oklahoma goes red in the presidential elections. But if you lived in Oklahoma and you drilled into the political scene, you would find that that is not a very clear reflection for where we really are positionally. And I think it's very important that you know that. It is a very mixed bag. Yes, we're conservative. Yes, we have Republican governor, Republican lieutenant governor, Republican-controlled House, Republican-controlled Senate, Republicans at the county level, Republicans and all the agents. I mean, we've got it all, you know? Except we don't do a lot of the right things. So here I am in the mix of this, and I'm asking myself, what do I do, God? I feel like I'm supposed to be here. I'm pastoring. I'm doing this black robe thing all over the country. How am I going to juggle all of this? And so for a couple of terms, I was there. Now, my third term, I was running unopposed. I tell people, even I could win that race, right? I mean, I didn't have an walk away. And here's the reason why. I'm not a quitter. I've never been a quitter. But I just decided that we could do a lot more good pastoring and traveling, telling the story of what the church did at one time in America to make a real difference when we were literally the tip of the spear. And so I felt like that was more effective, so I walked away from the legislature. They were killing all my bills anyway, and so I wasn't getting the things done that I felt like I needed to do. But I learned a lot about being behind the scenes, and of course, as I told you about a year later, I had a relapse and ran for governor, so who knows what I'm going to do next. But in the midst of all of that, I learned some things that I would want to share with you. Now, I'm coming from Oklahoma, primarily a Judeo-Christian, strong state. Baptists are the largest group of evangelicals. Out of 3.9 million citizens, 1.3 million are self-professed born-again Christians. Okay? So that's a third of the state that claim to be evangelical. That doesn't include all the other faith groups. That's just the evangelical. So you would think that in a state like that, we could get a lot of things done. So my job here in the next 25 minutes is to share with you what I discovered in the legislature, what you need to understand if you don't already about what your legislators face and how to work with them, to pray for them, but to also figure out what it is they're trying to say to you when they're trying to butter you up and make you think that they're going to do exactly what you're there asking them to help you to do. So let me begin by rehearsing for you my first few months in the legislature, just to kind of give you the general feel. The minute I get there, you know, you're trying to learn where everything is. Our Capitol buildings are probably a lot like yours. It's very easy to get lost in. I spent the first month or two just finding where the bathrooms were. I mean, every time you get in there, you lose direction. And so trying to find my way around. Well, about a month into my freshman year, I overhear some of my classmates, those who were elected when I was elected, talking about doing all these fundraisers and how much money they had their campaign fund. And I'm thinking, for Pete's sake, we emptied ours, and I haven't had one fundraiser. I'm thinking, man, I'm behind. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, well, that's not why I'm here. I am not here so I can hold fundraisers immediately so I can get reelected in 2 years. So I said to some of them, don't you think before we start working on getting reelected, we ought to do some governing first, and then maybe, just maybe, we can run for reelection? So I found that for many, there's a lot of things that happen when they get elected. Number one, they get this massive rush of importance. Now all of a sudden, they're honorable this, representative that. What do I call you, sir? What do I call you, ma'am? And they're treated differently, right? Well, if you're not careful, if you're not grounded, that'll go to your head. And it'll go to your head fast. Not only that, but you have big-time companies, corporations, and business leaders who want to take you out to lunch. They want to buy you supper. And they just want to be your friend, right? Of course, you know there's more to it, but if you're not careful, it runs to your head. And then, of course, the fundraising, the idea that if I'm going to stay here and make a difference, I've got to be able to keep a campaign fund going. I've got to begin to raise money. And unfortunately, it doesn't take very long where the primary reason they were elected is so they could be reelected. Because it's going to look bad if they just get elected for one term and then get booted out because they didn't work hard to raise money and get ready for that next election. And believe you me, it is expensive to run for office. In my gubernatorial run, just in the primary itself, we raised and spent $340,000. Now, we did very, very well, very well. Most people thought that we wouldn't do anything. Out of a field of about 10, I came in fourth. Now, I finished behind the present governor, the lieutenant governor, and the ex-mayor of Oklahoma City. So these are big movers and shakers. I'm told that in that same primary, forget about runoffs, forget about generals, just in the primary, those three spent a combined $12 million compared to our $340,000. So understand, fundraising is an issue if you're gonna run for office and you're going to remain in office. Then, of course, there's the peer pressure. Immediately, you know, you're put on committees and people look at you and they say, hey, you've got a future there, man. If you play it careful, you're going to go far. And you begin to think about this, you know, and they put you in spots and places. Of course, you don't realize then, they're just setting you up. See, they're just setting you up to become their puppet because they'll give you a position and then you don't want to lose that position because that's a demotion. So what are you going to do? Well, you're going to work really hard to retain that position, right? But not just retain it, you're going to get even higher position. And so this whole thing begins to crash on you. And then when you do begin to try to make a difference, the press is on you like that. They don't care a thing about what you do until you do something they don't like. And then they are on you. And here's the problem. They make you think they care about your opinion. So all these guys are getting interviewed and they're like, man, they like me. They want to know what I think. And so they just start spilling their guts. And all those guys are doing is they're listening for the 10 or 15 seconds of the dumbest thing you said so they can air that night on the news. And if you didn't say it stupid enough, they'll edit it to make it stupid enough. That's exactly what happens. I mean, I was running one particular bill. It was very controversial. And the press were just hounding me. And finally, my L.A. legislative assistant, kind of like a secretary, called me. She said, look, don't come to the office. There's a news crew that's been sitting here all afternoon, and they're going to ambush you. I said, well, I've got to come back. I've got to get my coats in the wintertime. I need my briefcase, my bag, my computer. So finally, when it's all said and done, session's over for that day. I go in there. There they are. I just walk past them, go into my office, get all my stuff. I'm coming out and close the door. I said, Representative Fisher, we'd like to interview you on this particular bill. And I said, well, I'm not interested. Oh, Representative Fisher, don't you want to get the truth out? I said, you guys haven't told the truth yet. Why in the world would I want to start trying now? And so I literally, not in a rude kind of way, walked away from them. But you see, a lot of guys don't learn that. So they keep getting sucked in. And so all of this is happening now. Add to it the fact that in Oklahoma, if you run as a Republican and you're not pro-life, you're not getting elected. That's just the way it is. So unfortunately for many of these men and women, pro-life is just another one of these positions that they have. It's not something down in their core. And if it is in their core, it's only at the pro-life level. It's more theoretical to them. You just heard a while ago Representative Scott, right? Heather Scott, right? Because this is Scott Herndon, so it kind of gets confusing for me sometimes. So anyway, Representative Scott said that when she went there, she didn't even know. I mean, now she's an abolitionist. But she said, I'm pro-life. But obviously, she did not have the deep-rooted convictions that she has today. And yet, she would have told you, I'm pro-life. Well, this is where all of them are. Now, we're never going to really get these guys to do what they need to do until they see abortion for what it is. Now, you know, this has already been said, not only at this conference, but probably at conference after conference, and you've said it too. But until a person sees abortion as murder, until a legislator sees it as murder, it's just another theory. It's just another thing to them, and they may care about it, but they don't see it as murder. Now, why is that? Well, I don't really know, because I fell into the same category. I've been a preacher for years. I've been pro-life. I was involved with Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority way back when they were a big deal in the early 80s. He would fly in and out of our church in Fort Smith where I was on staff. And I was rubbing shoulders with all the early pro-lifers, and I always thought we wanted to end abortion. But something happened, and I didn't know what happened nor when it happened. But suddenly, that was not the goal. Until we see it as such, we won't treat it as such. Now, let me give an illustration. On September the 17th, 1862, there was a battle fought right outside of Sharpsburg, Maryland. You know it as the Battle of Antietam. On that battle, during that battle that day, there were 28,000 casualties. It's not the bloodiest battle, but it's the bloodiest one-day battle of the entire war between North and South or between the United States and Confederacy. The bloodiest one-day battle. But something unique happened with that battle that had never happened before, not in all of history. A photographer by the name of Matthew Brady was able to get to the battlefield before they buried all the dead. And he was able to take photographs of bloated, dead soldiers, some of them lying where they had fallen, others gathered together to be buried in trench graves, unknowns, maybe 10, 20, 30 of them at a time. And he published those pictures. And for the first time, the American public, in a war that had now been going over a year, other than those that had maybe been close to a battlefield and had seen it, you know, firsthand, but that was few people, saw in the newspapers and in other periodicals pictures. And journalists said, Mr. Brady has, if not brought the war to our kitchens, done the next best thing and has pictured it for us and brought it into our kitchens. And for the first time, Americans saw what that war really was. And they began to see it as the grotesque thing that they were engaged in. That's what's got to happen. Now, we've got to be tactful. I believe that we've got to be professional. But we've got to be able to somehow help people get to the place where they understand. And sometimes I'm convinced that only God can do it. Now, let me tell you, as a pastor, I know that pastors are not much help right now. The majority of pastors do not see it as murder either. Oh, now, if you ask them, is it murder? They'd say yes. But they do not see it as murder. They will only preach about it maybe once a year at Sanctity of Life Sunday. They kind of do their obligatory sermon. But they are actually the bottleneck in many instances. In many ways other than just this, they do not see it on top of it because they don't see it as murder and do not understand that this alone, this one thing alone could bring God's judgment down on us and wipe us off from the face of the earth and probably should, but for His mercy. They're not going to preach that. So their people aren't going to think that either. Now, I discovered something when running for governor that I'll cover in just a moment, that really the people are better off than most of their pastors. I'll share that with you in just a moment. But I do believe that the church is problematic. Now, this last year in our legislature, we ran SB 13. Most of you know what that bill was. That was a bill that would have criminalized abortion as murder in Oklahoma. Senator Joseph Silk, that I worked with a lot when I was there, I know him quite well, was the sponsor of this, and it was killed. But do you know who helped kill it? The preachers in Oklahoma. The Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma, the Southern Baptist branch of pastors in Oklahoma, some of them I know quite well, fought it. Issued a letter that went out to all of their pastors all across Oklahoma. Now, churches are autonomous in the Southern Baptist Convention. They can't be told what to do, but understand when the head honchos, the big cheeses, send out a letter that says, look, we're not for this, and here's four reasons why, and you'll go to hell if you support it. Oh, they don't have that part. But they imply it. What do you think the other pastors are going to do in these little podunk towns where nobody knows them and they really are just barely getting by and they'd like to someday pastor a little bigger church? They don't want to be blackballed by the Baptist building. What do you think they're going to do? Well, they're not going to support it either. Well, there's some of us that don't give a rip. And so we did a response rally at the Capitol with about eight of us Baptist preachers blasted them. Now, we weren't nasty to them. I don't think we ought to be that. But we were nasty about the issue. But it was the Baptist General Convention of Oklahoma that actually pretty much killed that. Now, remember, 1.3 million evangelical Christians in Oklahoma, most of them Southern Baptists, and the Baptist head honchos said, no way. Well, the people in the pew are in the same spot. They've also been taught incorrectly about Romans chapter 13.
Yep.
I have an entire white page research paper that I issued during the campaign. I'm about to have it published into a booklet. And I actually go around preaching and doing a presentation on Romans 13, trying to help pastors understand they've been lied to or misled about Romans 13. But see, they read it and teach their people that you've got to obey everybody in authority no matter what. Really? Is that what Paul was saying in Romans 13?
Yeah.
And it's not just Romans 13, because the Bible has a lot to say about submission in other places too. And in those places, wives are to offer unlimited submission to their husbands, regardless of what the husband asks them. The children are supposed to offer unlimited submission to their parents, even if their parents say, here, we're running a little low this month on money. Kids, take this bag of grubs, go out on the streets and sell it, and you'll help us pay the mortgage this month. Well, Mom and Daddy, and that is, we're in authority here, and you're the submit. Is that what Paul meant?
No.
Well, of course it's not what he meant. Well, then why in the world would we read Romans 13 to say the same thing? And yet we do. And the average person sitting in the pew, though they are not a rebel, don't want to be a rebel, and I would also encourage us not to have a rebellious spirit. God will honor that. But they think if you disobey a tyrant, you're somehow sinning. And even though I respect him greatly, preachers like John MacArthur help to reinforce that concept. I'll talk more about that on Saturday. But we must undo that. So the people in the pews, they don't know. These Christian legislators that I was working with, they don't know. And they're just going with what their preachers always told them. So when I would tell them, guys, we've got to stop this. Well, damn, we can. Of course, there's another problem that you've heard a lot about today. And that is their understanding that they're just a subset of the federal government. See, most people in legislatures, in state legislatures, believe that they are the minor leagues and that Washington, D.C. and Congress is the big league.
Yeah.
And that maybe someday, if you're good enough in the minors, you'll get called up to the majors.
Yeah.
And they really see their state as a subdivision of the federal government. Now, if they see it that way, and trust me, they do. Are they going to do anything to buck any federal authority whatsoever? Of course they're not. On the floor of the House of Representatives in Oklahoma, my job was to debate state sovereignty in a particular bill about Obamacare, and I said, look, if we're nothing more than a subdivision of the federal government, rather than spending $400 million renovating this Capitol building, let's sell it. It'll make a great museum. Let's lay all of us off. We can save millions and millions of dollars. Let's shut down all the state courts and all the state agencies. Forget all that. We've got all that at the federal level. Let's just rent an office building downtown Oklahoma City, call it the Office of the Federal District of Oklahoma, and just let Washington, D.C. tell us everything to do. I mean, what are states supposed to do? Well, let's see, you can pick the state bird, you can pick the state game. While I was there, we chose dominoes, which is a really manly kind of game. I'm so proud of that. State song, stuff like that. Generally in the legislature, that's what you're thinking around with, the stupid stuff. And the bills that get to you that have any kind of a substance is just another way to police the flock. Another way to increase what little bit of authority you have at the state level. But if you even suggest that you're going to buck the major leagues, these guys break out in hives and they're fearful. They're fearful. Even if they're not eaten up with ambition, they're captivated by fear. They're so afraid. They don't want to start a war. Well, who does? I know very few people who want any kind of conflict whatsoever. And these guys, like pastors, will avoid controversy at all costs. So, a bill that would put them in opposition to the federal government, whew, we ain't doing that. So that was kind of my experience. Now let me give you one example of what was going on there, and then let me jump to the governor's race here and kind of wrap things up. I was there in 2012. Before me, about 3 years before that, a bill had gone through the legislature. It wasn't a full-blown abolition bill, but remember, when I got elected, I'm still a typical Baptist preacher, and I don't know what abolitionist is except those that were against slavery, and if you ask me, are you for ending abortion? Of course I am, I'm pro-life. So I was going through my own genesis, okay? So I'm there, and as I'm running, people say, Dan, if you get elected, would you run this bill that would make illegal embryonic stem cell research in Oklahoma? I said, of course I would. Now, at that time, I didn't know what I know now. I would have said, well, let's crank it up a few notches. Let's just make it all illegal. But at the time, I was seeing it through, you know, pro-life eyes. So I said, of course, that ought to be illegal anyway. So that bill had already gone through the legislature 3 years before. And it passed. And it had been vetoed by our then Democrat governor. So they took it back to the legislature, the House overrode his veto, and the state Senate fell 3 votes short. Okay, well in 3 years, 2012, we got a lot more Republicans. We've got a Republican governor who says, I am proudly pro-life. And we have all these people, I'm thinking, my gosh, I'll just run the same bill and be a slam dunk. I ran the same bill. It was not a slam dunk. Do you know who helped kill the bill? the chairman of the largest pro-life group in Oklahoma, who is on the Right to Life Committee nationally. My Senate author and I met with him in the Senate author's office, and we said, listen, the chairman of the committee says he'll hear the bill if you'll just kind of give him the nod. It's all you have to do. You don't have to support it publicly. You don't have to sign on to it. You don't have to do anything. And he said he just couldn't do that. I said, you understand that you're going to kill this bill. Well, Brother Fisher. And he gave me that stuff. And so that man knowingly killed that bill. I think it would have passed. I think the governor would have signed it. It would have been a major step. It would have ended embryonic stem cell research in Oklahoma. And if it doesn't occur there now, it would never occur. But it was pro-life leadership that stopped it. Now that shouldn't be a surprise to a crowd like this. You know that. So that's what was going on. So finally, with all of that, and people would come up to me and say, Daniel, you make a great speaker of the House. Why don't you run? And I said, I can't get the votes of the moderates. And I'm not going to make the political promises necessary to get them, so I can't win. Even though I was considered, some called me the conscience of the House, which I wore with great pride. And they would come to me for spiritual issues and questions, but they wouldn't hear the bills. The only reason there was no response in Oklahoma to the Obamacare transgender bathroom decree is because I ran a bill and the Republicans on the committee, enough of them flipped to side with the Democrats and killed it. And it was a bill authored by the Senate pro tem and the Speaker of the House. Those typically are slam dunk bills as well. But they do all of this and they know how to pull the tricks and hide their votes, and I don't have time to get into that tonight. That's what your legislature or your legislator faces. They face that kind of an environment. So knowing that might help you when you go see them, when you write them, when you call them. Not to try to defend them, but you must understand the world in which they are living, and probably the world that is trying to blind them as well, if they're serious. Because I can tell you, the powers of darkness will not let them do the right thing without one heck of a fight. Now, as I kind of bring this thing to a close, I'm going to talk for just a few moments about what happened when I had my relapse about a year and a half later and ran for governor. I'm now co-pastoring a church in Edmond, Oklahoma, just north of Oklahoma City, with a man by the name of Paul Blair. We have a big, long story that I won't tell a long story, but I'll go into some of it when I speak on Saturday, because I want you to know how the pastor can make this major difference, if he will. But anyway, I'm co-pastor there with him. He and I work together a lot, and we both run for office. Unfortunately for him, he was not successful both times. I was successful, but that's neither here nor there. So I run for governor. My church was supportive, my leadership was supportive, so I ran. Well, this time I'm unencumbered by needing to please the constituency, trying to work through committee chairman, trying to work with the Speaker of the House, you know, all that two-stepping that you have to do to try to kind of, you know, dance the dance and still do the right thing. And lo and behold, I discovered something. Generally speaking, the people in the pews want to end abortion. They actually do. Now, they're under the false illusion that that's what the pro-life movement's trying to do. They don't know, most of them. Now, I'm not trying to let everybody off the hook. But for a good number of them, they don't know what a sham the pro-life movement has become. They don't understand that these legislators who knocked on their door and said, yes, I'm a strong Second Amendment. Oh, yes, I'm pro-life. They don't know that that legislator won't lift a finger to end abortion and will probably behind the scenes fight any bill that would actually come close to doing that. They don't know that. Many of them would come up to me and say, oh, do you know Representative so-and-so? They're from my district. Boy, they're a good person. I would stand there and go, and I bite my lip because I wanted to say, no, they're not. Oh, they may be a good old guy. And they may even be a born-again Christian. But they're not fighting a good fight. They're not. But as I went to these places, churches, I began to find that the moment I explained what abolition means and what an abolitionist is compared to a pro-lifer, they'd all come up to me and say, I'm an abolitionist and didn't know it. A state senator who wrote one of the strongest pro-life bills that was passed in Oklahoma, ever passed in our legislature, many of you saw some of his videos, Randy Brodman, said, I didn't know the difference. And he broke down in tears, and still does, and says, I am now an abolitionist. But that six-foot icicle that stands in the pulpit every Sunday in most of those churches, he's not going to dare let somebody like me. Let me give you two examples, and I want to close with a quote. I travel all over doing the black robe thing, and I've spoken at a very, very large church. In fact, one of the largest churches in the lot in Oklahoma, southwestern Oklahoma, down where the big military base is. And I did the black robe in this church, two services on Sunday morning because it's huge, standing ovations both times. Everybody was just going nuts over it. The pastor and his wife take us out to lunch. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That's unbelievable. That's just unbelievable. This needs to be heard in every church in America. We want to help you. We got to get the message out. Praise God. Right? Then I have another friend in northeastern Oklahoma, very large church, big First Baptist church. He had had me do black robe in his church twice. And I preached for him on two other occasions. A friend. So when I finally start running for governor, I sent out personal emails, not a blast, but two personal emails to those guys. I said, hey, look, you know what I'm all about. And I'm trying to get into as many churches as I can. I won't come and preach politics. I'm not even about politics anyway. I mean, you know, politics means polys many and tits are bloodsuckers. So, I'm not one of those. But I do want to preach the issues, which you have me. That pastor in Lawton, who said this needs to be heard in every church in America, said, well, I couldn't have you come do that. What? He just told me. This is the greatest thing ever. I got too many Democrats in my church. Then my good friend up in northeastern Oklahoma. Well, Dean, now that you're running for governor, I couldn't have you in my pulpit. Even though the attorney general of our state is one of his deacons. And when he had me to preach in his church those four times, I was a seated representative. Because you see, he's under the false illusion that if he has one candidate, he has to invite them all. That's not even true. Not in churches. Now, if they demand equal time on the radio or television, then that station has to grant it, but not to a church. Neither one of those pastors would have me. And I've been in both of their churches. That's what I found myself up against at the leadership level. But if I could ever get past those guys to their people. Now, a while ago, Scott, you said it perfectly when you talked about marijuana. Let me tell you why abortion is still legal in America. Now, I do all kinds of presentations about state sovereignty and about the incorporation doctrine and enumerated powers and all that kind of stuff. I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I do all this kind of stuff, and I travel, and that's all good. And I agree with Brother, help me with his name, he just preached before me a while ago. I'm drawing a blank.
Bradley,
thank you. I agree with Bradley. I've been in a number of conferences with him. But let me tell you guys, even though what he said was right, let me tell you why abortion is still legal in America. Because the people of God won't demand that it end. If the people of God would demand that abortion ends, it'd be just like the marijuana deal. It'd be over. Notice we didn't do any big appeals to the Supreme Court to legalize marijuana in our states. You know why we legalized it? Because the people wanted it. And you know why the federal government didn't do anything? Because they know the people want it. That's why it's still legal. It's the church. It is the church. The evangelical church. That's why. Now, I'm not wanting to be mean to anybody. Now, I want to close with this. I'm going to begin with this on Saturday when I talk about the role that preachers ought to and can play. This is a quote that was given in the 1800s. Some of you probably read the quote. It's by William Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, which was a lot more than ringing bells in front of Walmarts in December in those days. Of course, there's still more than that even today, to be fair. I want you to listen to what he said. The chief danger of the 20th century, now he's predicting 100 years into the future, which of course we're now in the 21st century. But he said the chief danger of the 20th century will be religion without the Holy Ghost, Christianity without Christ, forgiveness without repentance, salvation without regeneration, politics without God, and heaven without hell. Now, if you break that quote down and you look at every one of those, and I have in sermon series, we're suffering from every one of his predictions. So if the church does not wake up, now we need to do all this other stuff, but if the church does not wake up, friends, I believe that our future could involve some very, very dark days.
Yeah.
I'm not a prophet of doom, and I don't even want to be. I'm telling you. So that's what it's like to be behind the curtain of the legislature, to run for governor. Just a little peek into it. I hope this has been helpful. I don't want to be redundant from what all the other guys have said. Just remember, these guys are under an enormous amount of pressure. Don't cover for them. I'm not asking you to feel sorry for them. Just understand that. That's why we need men and women like you running. You say, who, me? Yeah, you. You need to run if you can't be bought or pressured. Now, if you can be bought or pressured, don't do it. But if you can't be bought or pressured, do it. And if one term is enough, when I ran for governor, I closed with this. I lied a while ago. Let me close with this. Sorry. I was running for one term. Now, I didn't promise only one. Of course, no problem. You can only have two. But I was only running for one. In fact, had I been elected, I looked to be arrested. Not because I'm mean or obnoxious or a rebel without a cause. Wasn't it at all. I'm not an anarchist. I believe in the rule of law, and I wanted to help return the rule of law to my state. But I was willing to run for one term and to get my can kicked out of office. That wasn't my goal, but that was what I was willing to do. That's what we need. We desperately need that today. God bless you for what you do, because you guys are in the trenches doing a whole lot more than guys like me. God bless you. Scott, thank you for letting me share. Paul, thank you for letting me. I look forward to being with you guys over the next few days. God bless you. Be here on Sunday to see the black robe if you can. Thank you.